Hello, I am your host, Nina Bullock, and welcome to the Brown Girl Dreaming Podcast, where this first episode is a textual analysis of the 2018 novel, Friday Black, by Nana Kwame Ashtey-Brenya. This novel contains 12 short stories where Brenya explores the themes of racism, consumerism, and violence. However, for this episode, the main focus is the theme of racism and its direct effect of police brutality on people of color. Now, in the first short story, Ficus in Five, it's set in the perspective of a young boy named Emmanuel, where he recalls the events of the beheading of five black children near the Ficuston Library, and the scenes dramatically change back and forth from his perspective to the setting of the court case, each time progressing until eventually Emmanuel ends up getting killed at the end, finally being reunited with the children. In Zimmerland, it's a daily routine to reenact unjust violence in parallel to the notorious shooting of the young black man Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman. Just like how the perpetrator in Zimmerland is not convicted, George Zimmerman was not found guilty of shooting the young unarmed black man. Careless judgment errors have been as common as they come in today's society. For instance, an NPR article explains about a black security guard who was fatally shot while detaining a shooting suspect. The police chief encountered a subject with a gun and shot him. The subject was a security guard, not the suspect. This shows that people are still so quick to judge someone based on skin color and still see African Americans as, quote, dangerous. Brenya also made sure to depict the transparency of how racism is clear within the novel. Early on in the book, the author paints a picture of how divided the country was once the tragic incident happened. Of course, there are two opinions of every story. The radio personality Brent Cogan made it so. Yes, yes, they were kids, but also fuck niggers, from Brenya page 2. His blunt comments made it clear that he was not for African Americans, and it also is a parallel to the current debate of how people who are not black cannot say the N-word in any shape or form. In the novel, it was a clear jab at being racist, and the fact that if it were said now, there'd be so much backlash against him. Now, let's move on to their texts. My role portion of this podcast, where we take this amazing text and connect it to the larger cultural landscape and how it connects with recent events in our society. Today we have a special guest, Miss Mia Barber, who majored in African American Studies from University of California, Berkeley. Oh, and another thing, she also happens to be my mother.
Hello, Miss Barber, and welcome to the show. So let's give a little background before we jump in. Would you mind telling me a little bit more about your knowledge in African American studies?
Hi. Thank you for the interview. My background in African American studies is I have a bachelor's degree from the University of California, Berkeley, with a major in African American studies, social science.
Okay, and now moving on to the main topic of racism, did you notice any parallels between police brutality now compared to when you were a young girl?
Well, it's very interesting. In today's time, you have a lot of videos now. You have a lot of recordings. So it may seem like there's a lot more police brutality now, but, you know, there just wasn't a lot of people catching it on recordings a long time ago. I was raised in Los Angeles, California, but I spent a lot of time as a young girl in Mississippi. And during that time, our family frequently talked about running with the police or individuals who sought to support the police. And it was, you know, it happened a lot. And so I'm not necessarily sure that it happens more today. I just think that maybe it's caught on video or audio much more, and people see it instantly as opposed to what happened in the past.
Interesting. Do you think police brutality is a direct effect of racism, or is it more complicated than that?
Well, racism itself is complicated, and so when you talk about race, particularly in America, and the development of groups of people that were sent out to oversee Africans who were brought here and enslaved in America. That's a history that contributed to the formalization of police forces. And so that's why you will have a lot of stories today where you see people calling the police on people because they're doing something they don't believe they should be doing, like barbecuing or in the swimming pool, because that's a history in America where individuals were used to, almost like a police force, to manage African Americans or have them act in a certain kind of way. So when you start talking about police brutality and the institution of policing, it has a deep, unsettling history here in the United States. So to answer your question, you know, is it related to racism? Yes, but there are also structural things in terms of how police are trained, how the dominant society thinks about what African Americans should or should not do. There's an interesting quote from Richard White, a very famous writer, who said, you know, "But the color of the Negro's skin makes him easily recognizable, makes him suspect, converts him into a defenseless target." So the use of race and skin color to target people, it has a really deep history stemming from slavery in America. So it's very complicated, but it's also very simple. I'm really hopeful that the younger generation, individuals that are your age, because you're taking on some of these issues like climate change and you're going back in history to look at how these things came to be, or you're looking at food safety and how food is being used in certain ways, and you're going through the history of food. And so the same thing about racism, you know, it's not something you can change overnight. You have to go through the history of race in America to really start thinking about what you can do to make a change in that particular arena.
Interesting. In the short story, Fingleton 5, Emmanuel's father emphasizes, "You got to know how to move." And it transitions back to the author saying, "Emmanuel started learning the basics of his blackness before he knew how to do long division, smiling when angry, whispering when he wanted to yell." Does this quote resonate with you in any way? How? Do you think this stigma plays a role in how black people are represented today, if it even does play a role?
Well, I think it does. I think that, you know, black people have to watch how they walk, watch how they talk. They have to be able to speak in, to change code and how they speak. They speak one way around one group, and they speak another way around their family and friends, because it has a direct impact on how they're treated. An interesting situation today, you know, someone will go into a store and they'll be told, "Well, we don't have that," or, you know, "That's not available to you." And you're like, "Wait a minute, I know that's not true." But at the same time, you know, you've gone through this instance time and time again, and you have these feelings about, you know, "Wow, it's because of my skin." Or it might not even be about your skin, but it's happened to you so many times that you can't help to think that you're being policed by the color of your skin, your gender, or just the way that you look. There are so many instances where you can easily be targeted, whether it's by the police, whether it's by a teacher, or you have a teacher saying, "You know, I don't like your hair," and you have these stories in the news about, you know, girls being sent home because they have cornrows in their hair, or you're being sent away on the plane because you have on a jumpsuit that someone thinks that is, you know, revealing, when it looks just like the next person, but your body is built differently than the other person. So as it relates to African Americans or black people, monitoring how they talk, how they walk, how they act. They have to do that for survival because someone is making a decision about whether you should be there or not. They shouldn't have that opportunity to do that, but in the society where there are clearly those who have more privilege, they're making these decisions. And so you have, you know, more people of color in prison. You have a disparity between who's being arrested doing certain crimes when, you know, it's happening at the same rate, but black people are being arrested at a higher rate than whites. So, and brown people as well. So, yes, I think that there is a direct correlation between that statement and what happens today in society.
And finally, in the short story Zimmerland, the main character reflects, I locate, your life is in the hands of someone who doesn't even know you and thinks you don't deserve it. Would you agree or disagree that this quote provides a direct correlation to police brutality, or is it that and more?
Well, I think it's a combination of all of those things. It is people, I mean, we have examples in the news where you can have the story of Trayvon Martin, where you have this person who is not a police officer, but he determines that this young man should not be where he is and decides to hunt him down and shoot him and kill him. And so there are countless instances where young people are, not just young people, black people in general are being told they can't be places and do certain things by people who aren't even police, right? So
yeah.
You have traumatic stories where people are being killed for whatever reason because someone has decided that they're a threat. They could be standing there selling cigarettes and be choked out. You can have mental illness and you're, you know, on the freeway and CHP is supposed to help you, but, you know, they beat up this woman on the freeway who had mental illness. So, yes, there are people who should not have the authority to take someone's life or determine where they should or should not be, but they feel that they have that right to do it, you know, and that's not, it shouldn't be that way. But, again, I go back to my hope and my thoughts about the younger generation that, you know, you guys are going to go in and make some different choices about how decisions are made and hold people accountable. You have a lot of police officers who are now being tried and going to jail for the things that they're doing, and that was unheard of just a short few years ago, where most, and if not all, police officers, even if the evidence was laid out on national TV, they're still being let off, but you're seeing folks going to jail. Probably they're not getting the time that they, you know, probably should get to do it, but it's cracking a little bit, and I'm hoping that this generation will keep holding people to the fire. Holding
wow.
up people to the fire.
It's a lot of weight. Thank you, Ms. Barber, for your thoughtful insight and perspective for being featured on this podcast.
You're
and,
welcome.
And that's a wrap for this portion.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
We're going to transition back to the main part of this podcast, where I respond to the main theme through telling a personal story in my life where I received a flurry of racist and dehumanizing comments that it really made me question why I was even black in the first place. Now imagine this, you're preparing how to tell someone how you think you won't be able to work with them because it's been difficult to make any progress when they are putting forth minimal effort. As he began his tirade of comments, ending with words like whore, bitch, and cunt, my heart sank as I tried to explain the text messages to my principal without crying. I stumbled over words with fear and disbelief. For the first time, I was afraid for my safety at school. Mind you, I was a freshman in high school in a new school district trying to adjust to high school life. Through all the drama and tribulations, he only got suspended for 5 days. But to be honest, those were the most nerve-wracking 5 days of my life. People spread rumors, took sides, my ex-best friend blamed me for his situation, which eventually drove me to teen counseling for a good couple of months. Thankfully, with the real support of other teens being able to share their own battles in a safe and secure group, and my parents, I was able to rise above it all and graduate high school with a no BS attitude towards people who I can detect are fake and not really on my quote squad. Oh yeah, you're probably wondering about that boy, huh? Well, he transferred to another school, so I never saw him again. With all this to say, I opened up about it because I also wrote about this incident for my personal insight questions when applying to the UC schools. And as I read the essay aloud to my mother for feedback, I cried reading the first paragraph. But when I finished, it felt so freeing, and all that anger I built up from the backlash of the rumors and comments washed away, as so did the incident. Now, as I speak it into this podcast, I've reached a level that I can speak about it as something terrible that happened and learn from it. It's like that song by Kelly Clarkson, "What doesn't kill you makes you stronger." This obstacle didn't kill me, but it sure did make me stronger, both emotionally and socially. In relation to Brynja's novel, specifically from Fingleston 5, Emmanuel struggled with who he was as a black person, always subconscious of his blackness level not going too high. However, in the end, he learned, just like myself, to not be afraid of who you are and what people's perceptions of you are. Because in the end, there will always be those people who will judge me based off of my skin color, and learning how to give into those irrelevant thoughts was a lesson I had to learn firsthand. As this podcast episode wraps up, I want to thank everyone for taking the time to listen through to the end, and thank you once again to Ms. Mia Barber for being a special guest on this episode. Stay tuned for the next one of Brown Girl Dreaming, where I explain why I named the podcast the way I did with a special spoken word segment by yours truly.